Blog Talk Radio.
Tennis. I'm your host, Bill Patton. What is Infinite Tennis? It's a connection between great minds and the simplest play. It's the metaphysical exploration of performance to let it all out. It's about longevity. Today I'm overcome with sadness that I have Torben Ulrich on the show, mostly because I'm tired of saying how excited I am all the time. Okay, actually I'm not sad that I have Torben on the show, and I think it's going to be a lot of fun. This could be the coolest show ever, so we can always strive for that. Some pros who are a little longer in the tooth than me have fed me some great questions to ask Torben, and we're going to ask him some of the standard questions about coaching philosophy and whatnot, and this is going to be a pretty deep thing is what I'm expecting, and I'm going to allow Torben to speak at whatever length he wants. And so get your listening ears on. And at the end of the show, there are going to be no special features. It's just going to be this really nice, long conversation. And so now it's time to bring Torben onto the show. Hello, Torben. How are you?
Hey, Bill. How are you?
Okay.
I hear you faintly. But, okay.
Do you hear me faintly?
Yeah.
Oh, maybe I should.
No, no. That's just my ears are very old, as you know, and so, but I can hear you.
Okay, terrific. So now it's come to my attention that maybe you're now living in Northern California.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yes.
So where are you living these days there?
I'm in something called Tiburon, which is a little north of the city of San Francisco. I'm sitting here speaking to you with a wonderful view over the north part of the bay. You know, I can almost see Doug King, you know, on the courts over at, that way over in whatever that territory is called, Sonoma,
yeah.
Napa Valley.
Yeah.
And that way over, and I can see up north till Portland, and then beyond. I just see the towers there, the Space Needle in Seattle, and then Alaska beyond there. So you can, and then the Richmond Bridge here is a little closer, and then the San Quentin Prison is just to the left of us here. So it's a nice view, as you can understand. And then there's some wonderful hawks and vultures coming down right over the windows as we are speaking.
That's great. In fact, I was thinking about the who while you were saying that, because I guess you can see for miles and miles.
Exactly, yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's
and
terrific.
Yeah. So, yeah, the who, I think, is a good, that's a good one, you know, like, who, you know, who the hell are we kind of thing in this thing that we're going
absolutely.
To talk about. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of depth to that name, and I think it's an incredible name for a band. Because especially or the anonymity. Wait, oh, we went and saw this band, and they're called The Who, and then people say, The Who? The what?
Yeah.
The where?
Yes. Yeah.
So let's get started with some questions. I mean, I think we're going to do a lot of this kind of stuff, I'm sure, but listeners, I'm sure, want to hear about Torben and what he thinks about tennis, but then I also think that we're going to get into what I've titled this show, Play, Play, Metaphysics, and Movement. And because I had perused your website a little bit and was able to get some information, but mostly I looked on YouTube and saw the ball on the wall and some musical performances with drain pipes and you making fun of your son in a recording, you know, choosing the song for the record. That's a big one. But let's talk about tennis. So where did your tennis begin, and how did your family get that going?
Yeah, I think it began maybe in the womb somewhere, you know, of my mother, maybe before that, also somewhere in my father, in the sense also that, let's say, I was conceived when he was still playing Wimbledon, you know, and Davis Cup and all that. And my mother was also playing sort of tournament tennis, and they traveled together and played in different events and stuff. So when I came out of my mother, so to speak, I was quickly exposed also to the courts in Denmark and the sound of the ball, and in that sense, you know, then I go back as far as all that, you know, and then my father at that time continued to play, and then he had previously been a soccer player, and he had been a cricket player, and he had been a skater, and so there was a lot of that kind of all kinds of ball playing activity around the house, and I took all of that up quite early on and played, you know, also a lot of tennis, table tennis at that time, and also what we call in Europe handball, and, you know, that kind of, you know, where you play to a goal, rather, you know, that kind of, you know, at that time also we played more handball than basketball, say, in Denmark and stuff like that. So there was a lot of that kind of ball-playing activity around the house. And you know, that's sort of the basic background for all of that. And I probably played tournament tennis very early on, you know, in given that setting, you know. And then my father was a soccer referee and I was seeing, you know, Arsenal and Chelsea and those teams coming over to Denmark, and so I had a very sort of healthy upbringing in terms of all kinds of ball playing activity, you know.
So I guess the main point So the main point of there is, I guess, just the exposure. You were exposed to lots of different things, and then
absolutely true, and then
you picked, and then there it was. I was looking at your website, and I wasn't able to easily navigate, but I did see some different 12 different sort of lessons on playing around with movement and all that. How does that relate to tennis and just kind of all around development of an athlete, or, you know, just the complete healthy person?
Well, I don't know about healthy persons. You know, I think that's a large question. What one understands by a healthy person, I don't know that I, you know, that's a rare bird in my experience. But in terms of developing, in terms of athletic activity. It seems that they're at least, you know, you could say over in this country for a number of years, it's been sort of like you start cut very early on and you commit if you're really, really serious, maybe you commit to an academy or, you know, that kind of thing, and your parents are sort of with you and take you in and out of everything. And I think the European approach in those days, at least, I know that can also have changed now, but in those days when I grew up, you were more into sort of what you would call versatilities or something, you know. So I played sort of across the field, if you will, you know, meaning, you know, you played tennis and you played soccer, you played table tennis, as I said, you play handball, you were skating, you were skiing, you were doing a lot of stuff, developing along the way maybe a certain approach or a certain balance or a certain this or that, you know. So those are a little bit like, you know, a kind of a narrow approach, which is, you know, going to Nick Bulateri's, like, let's say, Lars, you know, how Lars Ulrich, my son, he went to Nick Bulateri's and met up, of course, with people who were sort of also going, taking that kind of fairly narrow road. But whereas in Europe, at least in those old days when I grew up and maybe when my father grew up also, we were doing all that stuff and also cricket and whatever. So there was a sort of a nonstop activity, if you were across the spectrum, you were, that kind of thing. And then maybe, you know, a little bit later, maybe you were sort of saying, which way would I like to go or something. But I would say, you know, that if I played after the war, you know, in, let's say, 1946 maybe already or 47, then that Kurt Nielsen, who was 2 years younger than I was, and maybe he was 16 and I was 18 and we already played Davis Cup, that he, being 16, you know, he was looked upon a prospect to play professional soccer, you know, at that time. So it gives you just sort of an idea of that kind of thing. And of course, I'm not saying that cannot happen now. We see, you know, the quarterback from Seattle, Wilson, right, that he also, you know, he's a baseball player, and, you know, and it, when he's, you know, and all of that stuff. So I mean, it's not a unique thing that that we have sort of brand, I mean, go in different directions. But I mean, by and large, you could say that you take a Jimmy Connors or an Agassi or something like that, my impression is that it was a pretty sort of narrow field, and that's fine too, you know. But I just mean that those are the two, and then there may be some in between there or something, you know.
Yeah, I think that there's so much truth to that, that people don't necessarily need to choose a narrow path early on.
Yeah. Yeah.
In my mind, if someone's a tremendous athlete, they have a well-developed sense of movement and they just understand how to do things and be on the court, then it's just a matter of time before they achieve a certain level of excellence. The player who's not quite as gifted athletically may need more time to pass.
Or not, Bill. Or, I mean, you can also be so gifted that it doesn't, you know, for whatever reason, it doesn't happen or something, you know. I'm thinking of two examples. One would be sort of Pancho Gonzalez's son, who was immensely gifted, but maybe he was burdened by you know, by the image of his father and the pressures to perform in that shadow, if you will, or something like that. And another example was a kind of a famous musical family, Yehudi Menuhin, a famous violin player that you know, that had a sister and a brother, and they played sort of chamber music, and they were very, very gifted. And when they were measured in terms of musical giftedness or talent or whatever you call that, you know, then they were scoring very high here. But then there was a brother, you know, who scored in this kind of measure, you know, the highest that anybody had ever scored or something until that time. And that guy was so gifted musically that he couldn't stand listening to his siblings play chamber music, you know. So you can also be so gifted, or that you saw, let's say, a Gasquet or something, that he was so gifted so early that it was almost, you know, a given that he would come through, but then it didn't happen just as quickly as all that or something. You know what I'm saying there? You know, with Gasquet?
It can make for a complicated mess.
He was, I think if we heard it right, he was sort of featured on the tennis magazine when he was 10, you know, and as this, the inevitability of you know, the big, you know, being the next whatever, you know, that kind of thing. But then it didn't happened so quickly, yeah, because maybe he started believing in it too, you know, and then maybe it didn't work so hard or whatever, you know, or didn't really, who knows? I mean, and then there's the question of the passion, you know, and the circumstances.
Yeah.
So it can be very complicated also, or the people that you grow up around, or your siblings or your parents can also destroy you, you know. And
that's a great point, you know. And I have two thoughts for you on that. One is, it sounded like the key word there was burden, and that when, you know, if people feel a burden, then that's a pretty difficult thing to overcome. And then the other thought was that my friends and I, we used to sit and think about all the different things that can go wrong for someone who'd like to become a professional athlete. You can get injured, you have poor coaching, your body is not indestructible, your parents don't support your dream, blah, blah, blah. We came up with like 12 or 13 things that can wreck you.
Yeah.
So what do you think of the? Do you think burden is kind of the key word there?
Yeah, I mean, maybe, I think maybe increasingly, maybe, I don't know, but let's say I'm going back to Kurt Nielsen and myself, let's say playing Davis Cup or something, and then let's say we were playing in Aarhus, that's one of the cities in Denmark, and we saw this young guy, you know, and playing, and we, when he was 11 or 12 or something, you know, or 10 or whatever he was, you know, but there was no doubt in our minds that he would be, you know, he would be there as soon as he grew up or before or something. Because in some sense you could say that in those days, if you could see that more clearly, I mean, it's that guy, yeah. But nowadays, I think that you're right, there's so many factors that play into it. And it's not quite as sort of easy as just sort of showing up. What I mean is that, if speaking for myself, you know, that I, in some sense, I could say that I was just there, and it took almost care of itself or something, you know. There was no, I didn't have a coach that told me anything. I didn't have any people telling me this or that, or kind of, you know, that kind of thing, where or injuries, or I mean, all of those things that you say nowadays are kind of the also fear factors. Are you good enough or something like that? So I think that in the old days, maybe it was different. Let's say in a place like Southern California, or let's say after the war in Southern California, or it was different in, you know, eastern parts of Australia or something, you know, where there were a lot of people playing all the time, and maybe in that sense it was already quite sort of tough or so-called competitive or whatever it was, you know. But I think many people in those days, you know, if I think of, you know, those people that sort of grew up and were obviously talented, you know, like a Santana, if you know who that is, in Spain, you know, I mean, it was pretty clear that he could be a very, very good player, or Pietrangeli in Italy, or, you know, some of those people. I mean, it was very obvious or something, you know. I mean, it was obvious before it was obvious, if you can hear me like that, you know, where they didn't have to sort of go through all of this, or being part of, you know, a whole group of people struggling or playing, you know, what are they called, satellite tournaments or something. I don't know that I've ever played a satellite tournament or anything like that growing up. So, I mean, it was, the pressures were different, if you will, in those days. So, I mean, but it's not to, I mean, if, also we shouldn't sort of just talk about the old days, of course, but I just mean that in terms of being a very old guy and giving a certain perspective, then you could say that those years also, you know, the years after the war, in both in Europe and in this country, it wasn't, I mean, there were different, you know, different qualities, and you had to, the performative aspects were different. I mean, let's say right now I'm thinking about, let's say, Laver and Gonzalez were playing in New York, a five-set match in the Armory, I think, in those days in New York or something. You know, they were professionals, and we were in town, and I was playing sort of a different tournament in those days with, I don't know if it was, you know, 65, 66, 67 in those days. And then Gonzalez asked, because I was a lefty, right, and he was playing Labor that night, okay, can we play a set or something? And then we played a set, and then he said, no, I don't like this racket here. I think I have to go and string it. Then he had to go and string his own racket. Then we played another set. Then he still didn't like his tension, you know. And then he was thinking about this idea of two tensions, you know, one to receive and one to serve. And then we tried that, and then he would go in and get ready with another racket that he could string tighter like that. But, I mean, that was sheer. I mean, then he still had to play a five-set match with Labor that evening, you know.
Well, as with everything, I mean, there's a duality there. There's nothing new under the sun. There's nothing
of
new
course,
under the sun. Everything's things don't really change as we like to think they do. But
yeah, you're so right. I mean, the world, of course, and not. I mean, the world is chock full of dualities. It's almost all we have is duality, it seems. So,
let me my point there, because there's the duality of the fact that there's nothing new under the sun.
Right. Okay. But that's not necessarily a duality. That's more like it goes on and on. That can be seen as a non-duality, the sheer continuation of the universe or something. No? Hello? Hello? Hello?
Hello, I'm back.
Yeah, okay, okay.
So I guess
where were we? We were in the continuation of the universe. Did you hear that?
And then my phone all of a sudden bugged out. But anyway, yeah, the only constant is change. And so I'll get my audio editing software out and edit this episode before it airs on Saturday. But,
yeah, no problem. It doesn't. That's fine. It's good if there's a little confusion there, you know, on the part of people listening. Maybe they say, "Oh, enough of this shit here," or something.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is, yeah, okay, the only constant is change. Okay, let's change something. Let's have the phone not work.
Yeah, exactly.
But it brings up the need for adaptability, right?
Yeah, so that's a little bit what I think is nice, Bill, also, that you work with the contingencies and you don't mind the contingencies, which keeps everything playful rather than you want some results or you fear that you will lose or you're concerned with constantly this idea of winning and not losing, you know, and then you get into that kind of constant duality, which to me, of course, is sort of part of the not very interesting part of athletics as a whole, you know, and you know, so.
Sometimes winning is losing, and losing is winning.
Okay, and sometimes it's neither. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. And then, you know, you say, okay, let's stay with that for a while, you know.
Yeah.
And where will that take us, where all of that is neither? And then you so run with that, you know. See what you run into if you run with that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a phrase that I used to use quite often whenever I got the opportunity, and for some reason people didn't like it. I don't know why, but I used to say, winners play and losers stay home.
Yeah.
And the idea is that just being out there and being a part of something and being involved and having an opportunity to express yourself through it, that's winning. And sitting out is losing, unless, of course, you have a really good reason why you're sitting out. But some people were summarily offended by that, and I just didn't understand what they thought was wrong.
Yeah. And then, of course, you could say also that that's because the system is given like that. So, you know, the problem in our world, maybe at large, is this sort of this thing about being eliminated, if you will, either from, you know, the tournament or from the workplace or from the conversation or from relevance or, you know, or just eliminated in terms of dying or you know, or but then if you really look into that, it's not that easy to be eliminated from this universe, if I understand it right, because it's kind of nothing. I mean, really gets lost in terms of the sort of the you could say the elements of the earth and all the elements of the whole. Either you take the galaxy or whatever, you know, and then again, it's not easy for us to get outside of the elements of earth, water, fire, air, and space and stuff like that. So in that sense, it just goes on and on, like you say, and nobody really gets to go home or to be. In that sense, we all continue just like those people that win the tournaments, you know.
Yeah. So let's shift gears here for a second. I want to stay with the metaphysical that we're on right now, and then
okay.
And then in a couple of minutes though, let's get a little bit more into specifically into tennis. I mean, I'm enjoying this, and I think that it has a lot of value for our listeners. It sounds kind of like if you take stock of the value of life and death, then you realize that your tennis maybe doesn't have the same value anymore.
Well, I don't know about that. I don't think so. I think it has a lot of value. It's just that everything else also has, a lot of value. But if everything has to be ranked in terms of value, then we are just back to the same kind of ranking system. And then some things are eliminated because they don't have value, and some things are raised because they have tremendous value. And then we're sort of back where we started in some sense, Bill, is what I'm trying to say here. So I think, to me, ball playing has tremendous value, but it's neither more or less than the rising sun, or something, So I'm not making that kind of value distinction, I'm just saying it's nice to speak with you, it's nice to play, it's nice to look out the window, but it's not like I'd rather do this or that, I mean, at different times I think those things could be appropriate, if you will,
Yes. So let's go to
is that metaphysical enough for you?
Yeah, I think we've exhausted the subject, and now I think let the universe rest.
Okay, let's get specific here then.
Yeah, the universe is now tired from that discussion.
Enough of the universe. Let's get real or something, right? Okay.
Let's go.
What's your question?
Well, I think once we get extremely real, then let's rank our realness against other realnesses that are out there.
Okay.
Let's talk about learning to play the sport, right? And so,
okay.
As you see it, what are some of the fundamentals of learning to be able to hit a tennis ball at a world-class level? Where do we start?
I don't know, really. I have no idea. Yeah. Maybe breathing in and out. Maybe that's first.
Okay.
And that happens early, when you get out of the womb there, then you get a slap on your behind or something, and then you start breathing. That's a fundamental. And then, of course, if you're born blind or something, then it takes a certain course. And if you don't have sort of much sense of, let's say, a ball coming towards you, then that may not be a direction for you. It sorts itself out a little bit. It seems to me, you can hear and this is maybe your regret, if you will, with me, that you hope to get some kind of a rational conversation, and it's not happening. And then I'm not giving you much help. And at the same time, I want to to be as good as I can with you and say, I don't know because I don't have a recipe, and it's for that reason also that I'm certainly not a tennis teacher or something, and so I'm not the right person to really address that question. It doesn't mean that I'm not interested in that question, but
right.
It's more like I don't know what to say because I think that, you know, the ball comes and now what do you do? Well, you try to find out what you do or something. And then you take that and you kind of run with it. But if your legs are not so good, it's not easy, you know. And so you have to be sort of gifted in a certain way to take that in a certain direction early on or something, right? And, I mean, sometimes earlier and earlier. You know, we all know the footage of, let's say, Agassi playing, in Las Vegas early on. And I was there in those years. We were playing, you know, good, fun, pro celebrity tennis there, and Agassi was 3 years old or something, you know, and I mean he was tremendously gifted right from the start, and then there was the father sort of pushing him, and then there was Jimmy Connors taking a look, you know, and we were all around there, and then there was Gonzalez, seeing his sister, you know. I mean, there's a certain setting there that brings that kind of thing to its flowering or flourishing, yeah, or something, you know.
Yeah, fruition.
Maybe I can say something more that's a little or differently or something, but I don't know that I can come up with sort of, yeah, I have this method or something, you know.
I appreciate the honesty because I would rather have you say that than to try to put it on or something. I mean,
yeah.
I don't think that's
and
what
at,
you're making.
And at the same time, you know, Bill, also that I am interested in some of these things also in a kind of very practical way. I mean, let's say in terms of, we were mentioning this about the five elements or something, and the five elements to me, you know, let's say the earth, the firmness of the ground, the fluidity of water, you know, in terms of the fluidity of the stroke, you know, the fire in terms of the intensity of things, you know, in terms of explosivity, if that's the word, or, you know, that kind of thing, and the air in terms of endurance and conditioning and all of that. So it's not like I'm not interested in those things, but it's more like someone had to come to me and say, yeah, I'm interested in a certain, I've seen, let's say, your films, or I think what you're saying there about, tell me more about that, the five elements, and, you know, then we can sort of go from there, you know. So it's not like I refuse to try to look into all of that. I mean, of course it's interesting, you know, but in terms of being sort of what can you do nowadays to become a sort of a professional athlete or winning Wimbledon or, you know, and all of that. And also because I feel that it takes so many things, and then, you know, you have to be kind maybe to the sponsors, and you have to be nice to the people, you know, at the media, and oh dear Bill, you're giving such good questions, you know, and how you sort of have to sort of lick up to everybody in terms of sort of have a sort of smooth way. You have to have an agent, and the agent will explore the possibilities of you getting a good gig or you getting some nice shoes and getting a shoe contract, you know. And all of that is, I mean, it takes a certain person nowadays, and I probably wouldn't be one of those persons nowadays because I would have been excluded or eliminated or whatever you call that before that.
Excommunicated
or suspended for life or exposed to drugs or lifetime ban or all of that I'd get 11 lifetimes banned, something.
An 11 lifetime ban? And that's and that's probably a Spinal Tap reference. But anyway, so let's go to this though. I mean, I've heard so much about you and Jeff Borowiak, and I don't know if you remember my friend Maurice Newman, but Maurice tells a story about having done the one ball drill, and that was the most intimidating practice he'd ever had was doing the one ball.
You want to
talk about that?
So you take one ball and you watch it, and that's it. It's simple. Stay with it. See how long you endure. Speaking of endurance. Are you still there?
I'm still there. I was just thinking that there might be more, but I'm happy with you leaving me there.
That's all it is. You know, the rest is sort of like experience. I mean, in some sense, it's just sort of like, that's what that is, you know, in terms of just, it's almost like you could say, watch your breath, you know, when you breathe in, and watch it still when you breathe out, and then just keep watching it. But and then, having said that, you know, then there's a whole world that opens up, you know. So at that time, I think we were interested in all of that. Let's say, including breathing and doing yoga things or exploring, psychedelic drugs or, you know, whatever it was in those days, and then, keeping a note steady, you know, for 2 hours, like go on and on and on, and then when you do that, you know, there's a kind of something that opens up that you normally don't sort of, in this day and age, that you don't necessarily sort of hook onto or look into or, you know, that kind of thing, because there are all these worlds in those micro worlds or something, you know, and so there's a lot going on in, as you know so well, you look into breathing and then into this sort of the muscularities of the stomach, the belly, the lower torso, and how that relates to, you know, your forehand volley or something, you know, all that kind of thing.
Well, yeah, because you can feel yourself. You are more self-aware of what's happening. Recently I've been getting more into the study of the body-mind connection. One particular exercise from the person who essentially founded the field of body-mind counseling. What she does, she has an exercise where you imagine the part of your body that's giving you trouble, and you imagine yourself breathing into it and then exhaling out of it, and then emitting sound into it, emitting sound out of it. And I've done that particular exercise and it has really helped my back tremendously. But
yeah,
but actually,
that's certainly a good one, I think, you know. Yeah, that definitely is a good one.
I want to get back to the one ball thing in preparation for this talk with you, you know, I thought, wow, you know, if I'm going to talk to Torben about one ball, I should try this out myself. I have my basket with 250 balls in it, and
exactly, Bill. Exactly. That was already the point of that also, in that sense of a kind of a, let's call it a frugality, or if we're a little bit more sort of lofty, we could also call it an ecological approach, you know, where you would say one ball is plenty, you know, one ball is enough, because, you know, we are so used to always having, let's say, all these balls, or let's say when we are playing, right, we are serving, and then the first ball is fault, and then lo and behold, now we get a second one, you know, and then you could say, well, you know, here when there's only one ball, you don't get a second one. You see what I'm saying a little bit? So it's, you know,
absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And so what it means is that you have this precious ball, and it looks very much like the sun and the full moon and the earth. You know, if you look from, you know, nowadays you can see the earth also from outside, right? And the earth also looks like a ball, like one ball. But then we know, of course, the sun is another ball, and then on and on. So all of a sudden, of course, we are back to multiplicities. But we have this one ball, and it opens up a lot of multiplicities within that one ball, and then we get an understanding of both the one ball and the many, many, many balls of the galaxy and the universe or something. And I'm sorry if I still get back to this universe. I promise you, I'll try to stop now about that. But
the universe had had a little break, and so it was ready for a little more. But
right.
Let me show you the practical thing that was amazing that happened when I switched from using 250 balls to only one. Only one. Now my player felt a sense of responsibility to keep the one ball going.
Yeah. Keep that word there, responsibility. That's very nice.
Maybe that doesn't capture it, okay? Maybe at first they felt responsibility, but then what ended up happening was they felt freedom.
Exactly.
It was really, truly amazing. I think when we have 250 balls, we're asking our people to make lots of mistakes.
Yeah.
The question is, what are you going to do with these two?
It's a little bit like, because we think we can afford it, and then it's also a kind of a devaluation of the one ball, you know, which is already a precious thing, you know.
Yeah.
And so that, I mean, a little bit of all, you know, of course, I said to you, it's very short, just watch the ball and then continue from there. But we've already talked about a lot of sort of facets that opens up, both in terms of the narrow field of the court, and then you have one ball, and it means that if it goes away, you have to pick that one up, right? And then you stay with that, and you're also concerned with, you know, if how long can it last, and then what's the critical limit of the life, if you will, or the endurance of a certain ball, or the way it bounces when the cover of the ball or the skin of the ball sort of gets worn, you know, or wet or something, you know, and so it's a little bit in our consumer society, then we say, okay, we're too spoiled with you mentioning sort of a basket full of balls or a can full of balls, be it three or six or how many there are. But let's just be with one ball and let's appreciate one ball, you know, and then let's say it's okay, you know, and then go from there. And that doesn't violate that Gonzalez still felt that it was good to have two rackets, one to serve and one to return, etc. And we can go into the multiplicities from there. But I just mean that if you say what was all that about, it was about a certain approach, if you will, to the ecology of all of that, or you know, because ecology was part of you know the post 68 era when you said did you and Borowiak, Jeffrey Borowiak, and Jeffrey and I were sort of traveling together or hanging out or listening to music and traveling also with, you know, Ray Moore and Thomas Koch and those people that were interested in the new music or interested in that whole world of that opened up with all that music and new kinds of thinking and all of that, you know, in those days, post 68, you know.
Yeah, let's pause there for a moment because I can tell a new topic wants to emerge here. But remember how we were talking about how we were going to meditate, right? We were going to let people meditate. They were going to listen to us meditate. So how about we do this? For 15 seconds, let's meditate on the word precious. Would that be all right? We're going to meditate. So everybody meditate now.
Okay.
We're meditating. Shh. So we're done meditating on the precious. Okay, good. Because I think Americans, I don't know that we can handle meditating for more than about 15 seconds at first, because you could get a hamstring injury or something from that.
Absolutely.
It could break the brain.
Yeah.
Okay, so now the other thing that came up recently, there was a specialty course, and Doug King was there, and Jim McLennan was running it, and all the Tom Stowe disciples were there.
And of course, Jeffrey Borowiak was a student of Tom Stowe's, you know.
Yeah, but an interesting thing came up was the concept of kind of the figure eight stroking style, and you know, whether or not Tom Stowe would accept that. But now, you know, so can you talk a little bit about, because I just heard this peripherally and I'm not sure how this relates. What was the thing about using kind of a figure eight infinity symbol type of stroking?
It was just sort of the ongoingness. I thought it was particularly a way to, when this thing, I mean, it's really maybe too complicated to go too much into it, because you have to sort of demonstrate it also. But it's a little bit that you, let's say, in terms of, if you, make a topspin backhand, you know, right now. If you make for yourself a topspin backhand and go from low to high, right? And so then you go from low to high, and then you go down again in a kind of a wave-like thing, and then you go back again, and then you make another one, and as you go down, you come up, and you make a kind of an eight. You hear that?
Yeah.
So the idea was, you know, when you approach that as a kind of a of a kind of a, you know, to stress the sort of the fluidity of continuation, you know, where you were sort of feeling the kind of, it was maybe in terms of, let's say, at the water element, let's say that if you had been talking about the ground, the firmness of your feet, both firm and light at the same time in terms of the ground and the court, you know, and then you'd move on to the, you know, now you're sort of, let's say, firmly and still lightly situated on the court, you know, in terms of a stroke, and you're light enough to move both, I mean, in horizontal terms, to move right and left, and then at the same time you're interested in a kind of a fluidity of both the motion and the striking or the stroking of the ball, and so you make that kind of a, let's call it a preparation or something, you know, like, well, how can I prepare that kind of fluidity of continuation and the sort of the ongoingness of the stroke, and in terms of this horizontal thing, it's a horizontal eight, and a horizontal eight is also the symbol, you know, the mathematical or whatever, you know, or arithmetical symbol of infinity, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
So you follow some of that?
I do. In fact, as a result of all of this, I actually went and tried to do some research on the origin of the infinity symbol.
Yeah.
Very mysterious. They actually think it comes from Sanskrit.
Yeah.
And it symbolizes continuous energy flow.
Exactly.
So it's
kind of, and it's also, you know, when it's like that, it's also like the sort of, it's a kind of a double. It's a double zero when you can see that it's actually two zeros that are lying close together. Then you get that same eight thing, and then you relate the zero also to Sanskrit shunya, which means and cipher, you know, like which means you know, also this idea of shunyata or emptiness that you also have in, let's say, in Mahayana Buddhist philosophy, and you have the same term also in Hindu philosophy, and so it's a useful and very precious, speaking of precious idea coming out of India in the old days, you know, that kind of thing. And at the same time, it's also the zero also is a ball, right? I mean, it's a zero. instead of being some kind of score, it's zero. So when we were talking about neither winning nor losing, then we get into the zero, you know, that kind of thing. You can see we can go on for days here like that.
Yeah. And I think that we've kind of, that seems to have run its course right there, and I think, and you tied it together very nicely there. I like that. So now let's take that, and what can we do with it? Okay, I mean, people are listening to us, and you know.
But maybe nobody's listening anymore, Bill. They've given up.
Well,
they think, yeah.
Okay, they've turned it off. And they're not listening anymore. And and what if they turn it back on again?
Okay, then
if
then it's their own. Speaking, you spoke of responsibility. Then it's their own responsibility. We can't help them, right? Now, then they're lost.
No, it is
lost.
Or it can be their win, or it can be their neither their win or their loss.
Absolutely.
So how does this approach to nothingness, how does that free up someone who'd like to excel?
Uh, I don't know. I mean, it depends on what kind of, I think, what kind of level you're talking about. I think if you know, what do you mean excel? Because you want what does that mean to excel? You know, I mean, I have to ask that question politely. I mean, we can take that in terms of you know, winning Grand Slam, or we can take it to being you know, I don't know, the next Pope or something. You know,
okay,
what does that mean?
Well, yeah, I mean, so there's your full range right there. And
yeah,
now,
yeah.
Let's just take it like this. Let's take it as excelling being someone's personal best expression of all the best that they have.
Yeah. But, I mean, it could also be, to me, to excel would first of all mean to be rid of everything that pertains to excellence, and then see what's left, and then work with that, you know. Because it's, to me, you know, the concept of excellence will sooner or later become a kind of an obstacle, you know, because then you're more like still, you're hung up on some kind of goal or something, and then I could say if your goal is to win Wimbledon or something, I cannot help you because if it happens, it's just fine. But as a goal, I would question it because I think it could also sooner than later, it could also be an obstacle. But it could also be that you had that as a sort of absolutely, absolutely burning passion, and then you win Wimbledon, and then you've fulfilled your goal, and then that, if you feel that was your destiny, and then now you're great, and now you can rest, and then that's fine too, you know. I have no problem with that. I just mean that I cannot necessarily be very helpful to you in, you know, like that, because I'm more, in some sense, you could say, more interested in being sort of cutting through the goal and to see what happens once you cut through that. Where what kind of space does that give you when it becomes not the goal to win this match or something, but just to play this match at hand, you know, and not be goal oriented about it, but to play with all the intensity that moment can bring, you know. But I feel, to me, that if I have that goal, then that remains a kind of an obstacle, if you will. Almost like you could say you have the net is an outer obstacle, you know. You have to get it over the net, but internally, for me, that shows up as an obstacle that I have to be aware of or something, and then maybe to say let's not necessarily carry that goal around or something, and then see what happens. And then to me, you know, that's more exciting, and that's also of course why I cannot be very helpful in terms of winning this or that or becoming a great player or something, you know.
Yeah. So I think it's time now to talk about Metallica.
Okay, let's do that.
So, now, this is funny because I already know you might not like this question. I don't know. You probably will like it, but you won't like it in the same way that people want you to like it.
Okay.
The question is from somebody, and I'm not going to name him because I don't want to point him out.
Yeah.
Okay. How did you feel about Lars's tennis, and were you disappointed that he didn't do better? And
I mean, absolutely not. And then if I should expand on that, then I would say that the very way that he was growing up, you know, his mother and I were delighted that he was so interested in music, and he was interested in ball playing, and he was very interested in films, and he was interested in all that, you know. And one of the things that we wanted for him, we could see increasingly. Can you hear me?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah. Okay. Well, one of the things was that, let's say, maybe if we felt a little bit like this, that if he were to go the sort of the tennis way, because he was playing a lot, you know, then he was playing with his cousin, you know, my brother, you know, also a Davis Cup player. He had a son, and they grew up together, and they all played a lot, and Jan Leschly's boy also, and so they, you know. So, in other words, I knew Nick Bulateri sort of way before the academy, if you will, and mm-hmm. and so one question was if it was something for Lars to go to that kind of a tennis school when that time came, so that he could see that if he wanted to go that way, then he could go that way, and if he were more thinking, you know, going in the direction of music or some other way, then he could do that. But if, let's say, in terms of the music, that you wouldn't necessarily have to be sort of really honing in on the music when you were, you know, I don't know, 13, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, whereas we felt increasingly that if you were to become sort of really, you know, a traveling tennis player like that, then you had to sort of get your ass onto that course, if you will, or something.
Right.
And then he did go to Nick Bulateri's, and you know, and then that was fine. And then afterwards, he was going on to the tennis team, and he had this, you know, Roy Emerson's son, Anthony. They were also buddies, and then Anthony was playing on this tennis on this high school team down in Newport and you know, just south, you know, yes, in Newport, and then let's say Lars would stay at Nick Bulateri's for a whole season, and then move on to this school and get with Anthony and onwards on that school team. So that was sort of one direction, if you will, and it was all there. And he did go to that school, and he eventually also graduated from that school. But he got so interested in playing the music and really being more committed to that he never really sort of played on the team there. And we were delighted, you know, that he wanted to do that, because to us it was a question of he, Lars, finding his path and what was right for him. And
sure.
If it had been, you know, and whatever path that was, you know, was just fine with us, you know. So he started out, and he was, you know, had a sort of a newspaper route or something that he was, where he was delivering papers in the morning down in Newport, you know, and then linking up with his music friends and doing the drums, which he had already done for many years, and he was still hitting a lot of balls and kind of a Western forehand already at that time, which was extremely Western relative. When I say that, I thought it was interesting that when he was traveling with us when he was very small, and we were playing in Australia, let's say, with Emerson and Roach and those people that did not have very extreme forehands, but he already from that very, very small from that time on, he had a very, very Western grip. And when he was 2 years old, we were wondering about that. But of course, later on, when he was ball boying for Borg and all of that, then all of that came a little bit. I don't know if you know that stuff with the hundredth monkey and all of that. There's some ideas about how all of that would sort of, you know, how we get to multiply certain things and all of that. But I mean, in some sense, what I'm trying to say here, describe for you both that we were so happy that he went that away, and he still to this day, I think, looks back on that, and it obviously it was the right decision, and so we were happy with the decision and that he wanted to pursue the music rather than going that other way or a third way or a 15th way, you know, that kind of thing.
Right. So, yeah, recently I visited with Doug King that you referenced earlier. And
yeah. In Meadowood up in Meadowood, it's such a nice place he has there.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. It's absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He related a story, and I'd like you to finish it if you could. But there was a coaching conference or something, and some high-level coaches were all there talking all day about their philosophy. And then the end of the day came, and each coach was supposed to stand up and say, you know, in so many words, what's their final thoughts of the day. And one guy said, keep your eye on the ball. And the other guy said, never give up. And then do you remember what you said?
I think you sent me these possible questions or something, so I saw it there, right? Is that what you mean?
Is this true that you said, hit the ball and remember there's great suffering in the world?
I mean, I don't know if I said that, but I think if somebody said that, that's pretty good advice, I think.
Yeah.
And then I think I certainly would, you know, say, that to me still is a kind of a burning question, you know, in all our selfishness and wanting to like we talked about, win and not lose, or be a Grand Slam winner, or whatever it is that we aspire to, you know, and of course in all the athletic lives, you know, and we hear this about that aspiration. To be your very best or something, you know. And so what does that mean to be your very best in terms of you know, also caring about the world? And I mean, that's, I think, we readily forget about that in all our self-centeredness, you know. And so that's to me is very sad, because we get in the world of tennis with all the material luxuries that we are sort of surrounded by or exposed to or consumed by all of that, we lose track of that and feel almost maybe entitled. So I think if we keep that in our thoughts, and of course there are people that that feel that, let's say, I'm thinking now, let's say a Federer that is doing something nice with children in Africa, and likewise Serena Williams maybe, and they're doing nice things, or we're giving to charity, or we're having a party, and Agassi has a wonderful school. And I think it it's that's so fine, you know, and that's so fine. But at the same time, I think that it's a little bit like it's so fine, but now I have to to focus on, you know, returning, you know, someone served. So so right now, excuse me, I cannot just think of that, but I'll get back to it, because if I win, you know, $1 million, I can give some of it to charity or something, you know. So what I'm saying in that sentence, I think, is a little bit where it's a little bit more in the stomach than whether you sort of give charity, you know, to children in Africa. I'm not, I please understand, I'm not at all putting that down, but what I'm just saying, that question, I think, is a little bit more like, you know, how does that suffering affect the stroke, you know, if, you know, and it, you know, and then does it play into that? Can you keep those two alive at the same time? Or you feel in our world of duality, we have to sort of focus on this or that or something. But, and so when you go onto the court and you think about, you know, the suffering, what does that do to your coming into the court, kind of thing? You see where it's going a little bit?
If you'll indulge me, let me tell you a personal story about my tennis, and
sure.
Tell me how you think this relates. Okay, so it was a time when my wife was pregnant with our son, and she was having a health problem that was a major concern, and so I'd been in the hospital with her for 72 hours, and I was scheduled to play a tournament.
Yeah.
So I told her, well, I'm gonna skip the tournament because I'm gonna stay here with you. So I'll just call in and say I'm not coming. And she said, no, you've been here 72 hours with me. You need a break. I want you to go play the tournament.
Yeah.
And then she said, but you better not lose. And I don't think she meant that. She didn't really mean that, but I think she just she didn't want me to be thinking that I had to be right back, you know, that she wanted me to go and really enjoy that. And I'll tell you what, it was one of the most interesting matches I've ever played because I lost the first set in a very tough, long hour and 15-minute set, and then I was down a break in the second set and came back and won that. And then I found myself down 4-love in the third set and 1 point from being down 5-love, and I just kept telling myself, I can't lose. I'm not going to lose. And I was playing with tears on my eyes because I was playing for the pain of my wife in her hospital bed, and that I was going to be returning there. And I was down 5-1 in the third set. Okay, I came back, rallied, took it into a tiebreaker. Now I'm down 5-1 in the tiebreaker.
Yeah.
And 13-all in the tiebreaker, I started to feel a little nervous. But I won the next 2 points, and it was a 3-hour and 45-minute three-set match. And you know, fighting tears throughout almost the entire match.
Yeah.
So does that sort of speak to what you're talking about?
I think maybe in your case, you know, I think that it doesn't. I mean, it can be so many different ways of just, if you see what I'm saying, that if you had that you had those moments, and as you say, it was a different, it was a deep and maybe different experience on the court, because you had tears in your eyes, and maybe you didn't you didn't have tears in your eyes very often, you know, on the court, right?
Right.
And so, and you still remember it, and it made an impression. And that's what I mean, that in some sense, it can be so many different ways of experience something deeply, other than just being sort of hung up on whether we are losing or winning or getting or getting into the next round or whatever it is that we are sort of sort of concerned with all the time. And then that, I think, Bill, you know, as your example there, and as it was your own experience, and it was a precious moment in your life, and also you said to your wife, "I'm there," and then she said, "Go," and then that was a precious moment for you. So I think, and I think, you know, I think that's one example, and then there are many.
Yeah.
There can be many, many, many other examples of that kind of richness. At the moment, for instance, let's say I feel I'm working on this film project also, where and speaking of Dog King, he's also seen some of this, and where I'm trying to. Also, in some of the images, to show, let's say, the sort of the beauty of the court as per se, meaning that the patterns of snow melting on a court, you know, and as an example of a wonderful sort of what the court can be in terms of, if you will, a painting or a kind of. That kind of richness of an aesthetic form that we're usually not aware of in the court, or seeing the net in its intricacy or gridness or you know, all the little knots that are precious in the net if you really watch it or something. So sort of see how rich or the fence, if you will, or the post that holds up the net, how, I mean, there's so many, you know, that wheel that drives when you have to lower or the net or something, and then you the camera goes into that and just stays with the sort of, let's say, the machinery of that, and then, you know, we're so, oh, is it 30-15 or is it 15-30, you know, but there's a kind of, it's such a rich world there, you know, and or the way the lines come together and or the paint, how the fault lines or, you know, I mean, so the court is such a rich place, if you will, but we almost never have time for it, you know. That's my point
yeah.
a little bit. And
well,
so that's what I mean, that
yeah.
we bring in, and that's why you said let's contemplate sort of precious, what's precious. And to me, to go to the court and then just see the ball in the air is precious, or the court is precious, or the friend that we play with is precious, or you know, our wife giving birth, you know, down there, you know, next to the court is precious, or, you know, I mean, there's so many wonderful things around the court, and there are also many terrible things that are happening around the court, and that's what I mean by there's all this precious beauty, but there's also an immense amount of suffering, you know. So we have to. There's so much to be aware of there, and then how to navigate that kind of challenge, if you will, to keep those things, not forget and those, you know, the sort of the apparent dichotomy of that, but then when you really look into it, we we most of the time also kind of run into these sufferings because we are just perpetuating them or something, you know.
Yeah. You know, I think while you were talking, I came up with an idea of a practical use that can be used for this recording, and it would be be like a Stanley Kubrick kind of a thing where you have a poorly behaved, you know, teenage tennis player, and then they can be forced to listen to this.
Kind
of like Clockwork Orange, you know. I think that it could be very therapeutic and coerced at the same time. So now we're just getting into the last wee minutes of our talk here, and I think that your
That's fine. Yeah.
Yeah. No, your last discourse there, I think, really was wonderful and put it all together. Is there anything more to say to bring this to closure?
I don't know what it would be. You know, some people would have suggested that we stopped about 89 minutes ago.
Yeah, and then just have silence.
Yeah, silence, yeah. But that can be frightening because I know that from the Danish radio we wanted to do this John Cage composition of 4 minutes of and 33 seconds of silence, you know, and the Danish radio project, they wouldn't allow it because people would lose the signal, you know. They would think, what happened to the Danish radio? Where is it? And
right.
So there would be likewise here. If we are not constantly saying something, they think you know, the station has vanished or something, or some terrorist attack has descended upon the machinery here or something. But Bill, I don't know if our time is up, but it was so nice to speak with you in any case, and if people have fallen asleep, then I think that's also good, you know, and then they could have, and then maybe in a few minutes they'll wake up refreshed.
Yes, they and the universe together will have had their rest.
Yeah, right.
Okay. And so in honor of what you just said there, after we hang up here, I'm going to have another 50 seconds of silence before I end the disclaimer. So, anyway, Torben, it was a pleasure to talk to you. So I'm so grateful and also, you know, thankful to Hella for putting us together. And so,
exactly.
Thank you so
she came here for dinner the other night, and we had such a nice dinner. And I've known her from she was a small child, you know, in Denmark, and so. But all the best to you, dear Bill, and take good care and regards to all friends out there in space.
Thank you, and I will call you my friend. I Torben, I'm glad that you're my friend, my brand new friend today.
Absolutely, always.
Take care.
You too.
Opinions stated by various contributors to the UR Tennis Network and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR Tennis Network. Participants are encouraged to use their own discernments and draw their own conclusions. All information, products, and services offered by the UR Tennis Network are for personal use only. The UR Tennis Network does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of information contained within the network. Any products or services provided for should be used solely for entertainment purposes. We emphasize the idea of keeping an open mind and not construing the products, services, or data as factual.